This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is Christ the Center, episode number 291. Today we speak with Dr. Mike Emlett about the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 291. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. We have an excellent discussion lined up for you today. Very pleased to welcome back to the program Jared Oliphant, who is a regional coordinator for Westminster Theological Seminary, working out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome back, Jared. It's great to speak with you.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be on again.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. We also have with us another one of our regulars, Nick Batzig, who is a church planter with the PCA, planting a church, New Covenant Presbyterian Church in Richmond Hill, Georgia, just outside of Savannah. Welcome back, Nick. It's great to have you on again.
Thanks, Camden. Good to be back on.
Well, today we have a very special episode. I'm absolutely thrilled to have with us today Dr. Michael Emlett, who is a counselor and faculty member at the Christian Counseling and Educational Foundation, CCEF, in Glenside, Pennsylvania. He's also a lecturer in practical theology at Westminster Theological Seminary there in Glenside as well. Welcome to the program, Mike. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Camden. I'm glad to be here.
I worked for Mike, more or less, not really with, but at CCEF for a few years. I was in IT while I was in seminary, so I got to know Mike and a bunch of other faculty members at CCEF, and just a tremendous wealth of information and assistance to the church, restoring Christ to counseling and counseling to the church. We'll talk about the ministry and the role of CCEF in a few minutes, but before we do that, I do need to mention that Christ the Center is listener-supported. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners to help us to continue to produce and distribute all of our programs free of charge. We need your help. We just hired a contract editor, so we have a guy helping us out. So we ask that you would help support us so that he can do his work and help us out so that we can focus on our efforts in producing these episodes. We want to encourage you to visit us online at reformforum.org/donate today. We want to thank you so much for your support of everything we do at Reform Forum in this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, Mike has taught and teaches a number of different courses at Westminster and with CCEF. They have a certificate program, but they partner with one another. So many of the seminary courses are taught by CCEF faculty members. One of those courses that he taught and I took was Counseling and Physiology. It's an excellent course that discussed the relationship between body and soul. And if, as Reformed people, the Reformed theologians, we do believe that human beings are body-soul unities. That obviously needs to come into play whenever we discuss how we ought to minister to human beings, and also what role things like medicine might take, and other spiritual issues, how they might influence and have effects upon the body as well. So when I saw that the DSM-5 was coming out, I thought immediately that we'd like to speak with Mike. The DSM, of course, is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual that is used by many psychiatrists and psychologists and other counselors to try to understand people's situations and the struggles that they might have. And that's what we're going to be speaking about today, the controversial DSM-5. But before we do that, Mike, would you just provide a brief introduction about CCEF to many of our listeners? I know many are going to be very familiar with what CCEF does, but for those who aren't, can you describe what the ministry is and what you do day to day?
1968, by Jay Adams and John Ballou, who were both professors of practical theology at Westminster Theological Seminary at that time. And the vision was to equip both pastors and lay people to counsel from the riches of Scripture. The foundation is that the Scriptures are comprehensive in their approach to human life. And we had culturally had lost that to some degree in the church. And so the vision was to, and you've already highlighted the Camden, the division or mission of CCF to restore Christ to counseling and counseling to the church. And that's really what CCF has been about over these 40 plus years. And our ministry is kind of a multifaceted. We provide counseling at CCEF. We also do training. So that happens through our both our on-site and our online courses. You mentioned the certificate program that CCF provides, and also the fact that we partner with Westminster Seminary to provide on-site master's level counseling degrees. And we also speak at conferences and produce resources, publications. So a number of the faculty have written books, booklets, and the Journal of Biblical Counseling is produced also at this point 3 times a year now in an online format. But that also serves as a resource for pastors, for counselors, for members of the church. So that's our hope. Our vision is to equip people to bring the riches of the gospel to bear upon the problems of day-to-day life, the sin, the suffering that we as God's people struggle with this side of glory.
Absolutely. And that it's such an important ministry and one that is often neglected, but I think understood rightly is something that we should all get behind. Of course, you can find many of the resources online at ccef.org. They have a great website, and a lot of their resources are available there, as well as information about upcoming events, conferences, that sort of thing. The JBC, you can subscribe to it online. You can also buy old articles. Not old in the sense that they're not applicable, but articles that have happened in previous issues, and also different multimedia things, videos, audio downloads, that sort of thing. In line with that, you did a recent conference on disorders, did you not, in 2011?
We did, yeah. We have a national conference each fall, and in 2011, it was on psychiatric disorders. Which is a timely topic, I think.
Yeah, I think it is. And also with the release of this DSM, something that we're going to touch on in a minute. Can you let us know a little bit about your history? You actually practiced medicine, and you're a doctor, but a different type of doctor than we usually have on Christ the Center. You're actually an MD.
Right. Yes, that's my background is in family medicine. I trained as a family physician, and then practiced in South Carolina. I'm originally from Pennsylvania, but practiced in South Carolina for 6 years. And during the course of those 6 years, had a sense of God moving me possibly toward gospel ministry. And so I came up here in 1996 to go to Westminster Seminary. And got my MDiv, and at that point came on staff at CCEF in 2001 as a counselor and faculty member. I had 1 year where I was still working in medicine. All throughout seminary, I was part-time in medicine, and then had 1 year where I was doing medicine a bit and CCEF. And then since 2002, have been fully on board at CCEF, and have retired from practicing medicine.
Hmm. Well, that's great. And you have unique qualifications, I think, to address this particular subject, as well as the general subject of the relationship between the body and the soul. Mm-hmm. So, now, as a matter of introduction, for those who haven't been following the news so much, they might not be aware of the DSM or, as we've mentioned, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. But this is a highly controversial publication, and even people within the unbelieving, section of psychiatry, there are people debating its merits and how it ought to be used. Can you provide for our listeners a definition or a description of what the DSM is and how it's used?
Sure. So the DSM is a compilation of descriptions of various named disorders. And the way that it is used, it has a number of uses, certainly from in the context of the clinical practice of psychiatry or psychology. It's used as a diagnostic guide. So someone will come in presenting with certain concerns, disordered mood, thoughts, behaviors, and as a result of that interview, the practitioner then will see if that person falls into a certain diagnostic category. So there are multiple categories in the DSM, some of which range from things that seem very clearly medical, if you will, like Alzheimer's disease. None of us would have any quibble about that being an organic brain-based disorder, all the way to other things that are clearly much more descriptive and don't have necessarily a clear brain-based pathology that you can demonstrate like you would with something like Alzheimer's. So when you look at the DSM, it runs the gamut in terms of diagnoses that really fall squarely in the medical camp, all the way to other things that are much less weighted, if you will, towards clearly defined organic issues.
Mm-hmm. How did the DSM begin? What's its history?
Sure. The first DSM came out in 1952, DSM-1. And it was a lot slimmer in terms of how many diagnoses were there. And part of that was because there were psychiatrists were seeing a lot more issues of mental distress after World War II, and they were wrestling with how do we classify these kinds of problems. And so the DSM was a way, the DSM-1 was a way of trying to categorize the kinds of things, the kinds of problems that people were presenting with. And so it came out in 1952, and there have been subsequent revisions of that every few years after that. 1968 was when the DSM-2 came out. And really where things changed, those first two DSMs were actually very much weighted towards psychoanalytic thought. So people had neuroses or they had reactions to certain things in their environment. But in 1980, when the DSM-3 came out, that's when the sea change happened in the way, if you will, taxonomy and labeling happened within psychiatry. With the DSM-3 in 1980, the move was to a much more purely descriptive approach to problems. So now you have a list of symptoms that comprise a diagnosis, and you're making no assertions about what is actually causing that problem. Mm. And the DSM says that. All the DSM since the DSM-3 have said, we're not making any value judgments here or any judgments about what is causing this. We're simply describing it.
It's kind of a posteriori if we used the philosophical terminology here.
That's right. Yeah. And that's part of the issue in terms of that you alluded to some of the controversies and discussions within psychiatry itself. This isn't a problem that is Christian versus non-Christian, or secular versus non-secular. Within, as you mentioned, the secular psychiatric community, there's a lot of discussion and disagreement about how should we classify medical or mental disorders.
Right. In fact, we've seen one figure, Alan Francis, I think was involved in the creation of the DSM-4. I might have that wrong, but he has a book which has come out recently, perhaps, well-timed here for an opportune capital moment, but his book, Let's Fight Big Pharma's Crusade to Turn Eccentricity into Illness, or that's a post of his, an opinion post, but he has a book on the very subject where, and, you know, he's not coming at this from a biblical counselor's perspective at all, but yet has significant issues with the DSM and how it's being used.
That's right. His book, and I haven't read it yet, but it's called Saving Normal.
That's right. That's right.
Saving Normal. And the subtitle is An Insider's Revolt Against Out-of-Control Psychiatric Diagnosis, DSM-5, Big Pharma, and the Medicalization of Ordinary Life. So that's a mouthful as a subtitle, but it captures, I think, what he's trying to accomplish in that book.
Right. And, I think you can run wild with conspiracy theories, but you can see a market-driven force here. If you have a drug that might do a certain thing, it's helpful to, have a self-contained or a descriptive disorder that it can address. You can actually create a market for yourself if you go and create a disorder.
Yeah, there's no doubt that the development of kind of the descriptive versions of the DSM and the advances in psychopharmacology go hand in hand. They do tend to inform each other for better or for worse.
There
are certainly benefits as well as costs, but that's exactly right. If you create a diagnosis, or you notice that there's a group of people, put it this way, you notice that there are a group of people who are struggling in a particular way, and you put a name to that, now at that point, other people, if you categorize it that way, other people can have it, so to speak. Identify with the group. And if you have a medication that has been shown to be beneficial in that group, that can also fuel the diagnosis.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, Mike, I had a really fascinating encounter just a few months ago. I ended up taking a guy who lives in the town I live in to the Masters in Augusta, which is about a 2.5-hour drive. And he was the lead pharmacist in the research and development of Paxil, which I didn't know when I had taken him. I knew he was a doctor and whatnot. And so we had about a 2.5-hour drive and conversation about serotonin uptake inhibitors and all kinds of pharmacological discussion. And he admitted exactly what you're saying about, we know so little about what gets tagged as a disorder, and they are just descriptions. And at one point, we got into the whole spiritual physical realm, and he said, I'd have to admit that there's many, many, many aspects that play into it, and lots of mystery that we don't understand why people are the way they are and why they manifest these things the way they do. And I was blown away that the guy that developed Paxil admitted that. Yes. So it's not just psychologists, it's the pharmacologists too.
That's right. There's if you look at the PDR, which is the physician's desk reference, which is this huge volume that talks about the detailed pharmacology of all these agents, many times they will get to that level of mystery and will say, we don't exactly know how this works in the human brain. And you can't. There's a way in which it is, it's an extension of animal-based research. You certainly have perhaps clinical trials where you're comparing placebo to active medication that allow medications to come to market. But in terms of actually seeing what's going on in the human brain, you don't know the detailed level. Now, again, that you don't necessarily throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are plenty of things that we don't know that are mysterious from a medical point of view, and over time they become elucidated. But I think it's just important to be honest about what we know, what we don't know. We can't measure levels of neurotransmitters in the brain. And we need to be honest about that. That doesn't mean, we never use medications, psychoactive medications, but the the simple kind of pharmacologic commercials you see where, you know, this is what it looks like pre-Zoloft. This is what it looks like post-Zoloft. And there's all these, you know, new neurotransmitters because you use Zoloft. That's simplistic. And psychiatrists would say that as well. Yes, that is simplistic.
Mm-hmm. Now, how is the DSM maintained and updated? If this is the fifth edition, how do they go about changing things and updating it for the present day?
So yes, there are a number of committees that form over time, and I probably don't have the ins and outs of the actual detailed process, but I do know that with the DSM-5, they have a number of committees. There's a mood disorders working group or a psychotic disorders working group, for lack of a better term, a group of psychiatrists who are particularly interested or have expertise in particular areas who are also using the DSM. This is one of its other uses as a research tool. So, for example, if you're developing new treatments or trying to develop new treatments for schizophrenia, well, first you have to be able to enroll patients who are correctly diagnosed, and so the DSM serves that role to be able to do that. And so, over time, what happens is as people make observations in their own clinical practices, as they do research, as psychiatrists in the community are reporting, hey, we've seen X, Y, and Z. We've seen an uptick in this particular group of symptoms among these people. That comes onto the radar screen, and maybe there's a study group that is put together. And this has been a long process for the DSM-5. The DSM-4 came out in 1996, and there was a revision, a mild revision, a slight revision in 2000. But this has been a very long process. And what happens is then once you have all this data, then you start to propose, do you need to make a change in this particular diagnosis? For example, here's one of the changes that happened with the DSM-5. In the DSM-4, there were separate categories for autistic disorders. So they were called the pervasive developmental disorders, and classical autism was one of them. Asperger's syndrome was another, and then there were several other ones that are much less known. One of the things that's happened over time is, as people have studied this group of disorders, is they realize, you know what, this is more of a spectrum issue there, as opposed to separate kinds of entities. So with the DSM-5, you don't have those separate entities. You have the autistic spectrum disorders, and I think that's one of the things that comes out of out of the process. Sometimes you actually decrease the number of diagnoses. Other times you're proposing new diagnoses. The DSM-5 actually has slightly less diagnoses than its predecessor. That hasn't been the case in general. It's generally been increasing the number of diagnoses with each edition. And then with the DSM-5, as these proposals for either changing diagnostic criteria or adding new diagnoses were put out there for public comment, so that psychiatrists, counselors, people could make comments about it, and you know whether how much of that feedback was taken into consideration, I don't know, but it was it certainly was not a closed off process. When they got to a certain stage, it was put out there for widespread comment.
Well, the uninitiate might get this idea that it's some sort of scientific findings book, that there are people in laboratories experimenting on patients and then writing down all the descriptive elements that of some problem this person has in their brain. But this is more or less seems to be committee work and polling of people to come up with criteria that loosely group people together into common groups that exhibit certain characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. The diagnoses, and I would say that over time, the DSM has moved from less of a complete, here's a small group of experts coming to consensus about certain things, to I think a better, more open process where they're also taking into account research and use of medications, things like that. So I think it definitely is more than just, you know, a group of guys sitting around smoking cigars in a back room, for sure. thinking of Sigmund Freud.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think what's important to keep in mind is that these are descriptions of disordered thinking, mood, and behavior. And in general, I mean, Alzheimer's would be a clear exception to that. But in general, they're not laboratory tests, there's not MRIs, brain scanning, those kinds of things that are used to make psychiatric diagnoses. These are based on symptoms and signs that people present to their, you know, to their counselor, to their psychiatrist, or whoever they're seeing. So I think that is important. And I think that actually gives us both courage and boldness as pastors and biblical counselors, that we ought not to be scared off by diagnoses, but that may simply signal, oh, okay, here are the kinds of things a person may struggle with. Now let me get to know them. Let me get to know the ins and outs of their lives and see if we can help them.
Mike, a lot of what you said relates to the post that you did on CCEF's website, DSM-5, the new normal ? And I'm wondering how you would approach, for our listeners, the answer to the question. One of the first questions you ask is, why are more and more people receiving psychiatric diagnoses? And personally, I just have a side question. I'm wondering if you thought about the relationship to this question and then the media, how the media portrays psychiatry, psychology. And I'm thinking of a few examples, but I'll let you answer.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I think there are probably a number of factors that go into the increased use of diagnostic criteria. Why more people are being diagnosed. I think one of those is because a lot of primary care physicians are making these diagnoses and using medications. And again, those two tend to go hand in hand. If you have a medication, again, here's another factor, the insurance piece. If someone comes to a physician and they describe symptoms that would be consistent with depression, it can be to that patient's advantage from a health, you know, what they're paying out of pocket to be on a medication as opposed to go for counseling, because many insurance plans don't pay for counseling. But they will pay for medication. So the availability of medications may actually have enhanced an increasing diagnosis. I think culturally there is less of a stigma to at least certain diagnoses. I mean, depression, anxiety, PTSD. There's the more, if you will, the more society says, yeah, we are, you know, most of us are struggling in this way, there's going to be a tendency perhaps for increased diagnosis as well. And again, I'm not sure maybe what you're thinking about, Jared, but certainly you see in the media that it's not, I wouldn't say glorified, but it's certainly common for people mm-hmm. To be portrayed or diagnosed, and for people to talk about their diagnosis or the fact that they're on certain medications. So I think that's probably contributed as well. And again, the more you just, you know, I've talked about this in Camden knows in my counseling and physiology class, but there can be sometimes a certain psychiatric field of dreams. If you describe something, then people can have it. And so if you build it, they will come. And so I think all of those things have contributed to overdiagnosis. I think the fact that primary care physicians are actually prescribing the bulk of psychoactive medications in the U.S., that's a huge thing.
Mike, I wanted to ask kind of the million-dollar pastoral question that's sort of related to this, but more with the idea of how do we deal with the fact that we know we have congregants who, even if they know some of what you're saying, functionally do think that Prozac or Paxil or Zoloft or any of the antidepressants or you know, those pharmaceuticals that are on the rise right now, in just common frequent lives of Americans. How do we deal with that as pastors? I mean, I struggle because, you know, I know that they're not ultimate cures, and yet I don't want to take a hard line and say you shouldn't be on them. What advice do you give to pastors listening to this about how to deal with parishioners that are on antidepressants, for instance?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the starting point is to get to know that particular person and the contours of his or her struggle. I think one of the things that you'll find is that depression is a pretty generic term, mm-hmm. And you'll find some people who basically have taken on that term or have been given that diagnosis when they've had a relatively normal adjustment, or it's an appropriate adjustment to a difficult life circumstance, versus people that may, for seemingly inexplicable reasons, have a melancholy that has descended on them, and despite seeking the Lord, despite you know, taking part of the means of grace, that melancholy is still there. Those could be very different kinds of experiences.
Sure,
right. And the person with a long-standing severe melancholy, there may, you know, I think one of the things that's important for us is, you know, as believers affirming that we are fallen body and soul, it is well within, I think, a biblical anthropology to say there are some people where the fall impacts them bodily in such a way that it may well be beneficial for them to be on medications.
Yeah.
And so I think going into a conversation with someone, say, who's been diagnosed with depression, you don't know. And so it's important, I think, to get to know them and understand the contours of their struggle. And that may give you a feel for where they are on the spectrum. And, you know, medication discussions way down the road, in a sense. But I think that's how I would start. You know, two people carrying the same diagnosis may have a very different experience, and so I think it's helpful for pastors to walk alongside, get to know them, walk in their mm-hmm. shoes, help get a feel for what their experience has been before making any kinds of value judgments there.
Right.
Yeah, that's helpful,
Mike. I was wondering, how much is what we're talking about a uniquely American problem, or are you seeing the same kind of trends elsewhere in other countries? Or you may not be, I don't expect every country, but do you have some familiarity with how other cultures respond to this? Is the volume increasing just worldwide? How have you thought about that?
Yeah, I wish that's a place I'd like to actually do a little more thinking about. But in general, as societies have become more westernized, there's been an increase in the if you will, taking on Western nomenclature for what's being seen. It's not that if you will, disordered, mood, thinking, behavior occurs in all cultural contexts, and right. People have what we call one thing in America. In inland China and rural inland China, it might be called. There probably is a name for it. It's just not westernized. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the things that you see. So I guess taking a step back, that kind of disordered thinking, mood, behavior, not surprising, right? Given the fall, it's just that in America, it's been over time expanded in a very codified way, and as other countries, other places in the world become more westernized, there's more of that importing of that kind of diagnostic system, as well as the use of medications.
One related question I've had, and I would love an answer if you find this, Mike, I'd love to learn from you, but China and other countries in Asia oftentimes will not let American couples adopt if one of the husband or the wife are on antidepressants. And I don't know if that's because they deem depression the problem, or if because of the some of the claims about suicidal tendencies with Zoloft and whatnot and other antidepressants, if that plays into it. So that would be an interesting question with regard to how Asia has viewed people adopting from other nations, adopting kids in those countries.
That is interesting. I'm not sure what the what the rationale is, if it's viewed medically as, okay, this is a medical problem that increases this parent's risk to be a good parent, or if there are other factors that go along with that. But that is an interesting question in terms of the rationale behind that.
So in terms of the diagnoses or the descriptions that we find in the DSM-5, if you can answer yes to the questions, or if you have a diagnosis, does that equate to a malfunctioning brain, for instance?
Well, that's the big question, and I think everyone would say no. It's not that simple. I mean, mm-hmm. that I think is the way it can be simplistically portrayed. It's interesting, in our psychiatric conference in 2011, David Pallison was talking about the difference between upstream thought versus downstream thought. Wow. Upstream thought being the halls of the academy, the research psychiatrists. You're not going to find anyone upstream saying, yep, this is just brain-based disorder, as mm-hmm. though it's not that simple. However, downstream, the word on the street is, this is brain-based. But the DSM is honest about that. It says in its, in its preface, we are not postulating about the etiology or the cause of these disorders. We're simply describing them. And so I think the answer on the one hand, the answer is, well, yes, of course it's brain-based. What isn't brain-based? Our conversation right now is brain-based. That's the way God has formed us. But it's not, I think when people say that, is it brain-based, they're thinking, show me the spot. Can you point to one spot where this gene or this network of neurons is off kilter. And no, we can't do that, and probably will never do that, because most things that are classified as mental illnesses are going to be polygenetic and are also going to have all kinds of other aspects, not the least of which is spiritual. Mm. Our circumstances, how we relate to one another, the environment in which we grew up, the choices that we make, all of those factor into the expression of a mental disorder.
Now, this just points out the tough work that is ahead for biblical counselors and for pastors seeking to help, you know, body, soul unities, individual people who have particular problems in particular contexts. And you might be under the false, some people might be under the false impression that, oh, I have this diagnostic manual. It's just like a diagnostic guide I might have for a car. Answer these 10 questions. I've determined, you know, that I have a faulty spark plug wire. I just have to replace the wire and I'm fixed. But that's not exactly, or not at all, what this book is purporting to do. What value does this volume have for pastors? It's easy to talk about the negatives, but does it have any positive value for pastors and biblical counselors?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does in a number of ways. I think in the first way, it highlights for us that there are groups of people who struggle in particular ways. And so I think that what that does is it raises our antenna to say, wow, I need to learn more about this problem. I don't know what's going on here, but this, if you will, this diagnostic list gives me some general guidelines for walking alongside this person, trying to understand the experience and asking them questions. A number of years ago, I think it may have even been when I was an intern at CCF, or I was newly on faculty, but I had a gentleman that I counseled with Asperger's syndrome, it's now in the autistic spectrum disorders, and I had not heard of Asperger's. It's actually been only a diagnosis since 1994 when the DSM-4 came out. And so it was helpful to me to pull out the DSM-4 and read about Asperger's and understand the kinds of struggles that this man was likely to have. So it shaped the kind of questions I asked of him. Mm-hmm. It shaped the kinds of expectations I had in terms of, you know, I want to ask him to do those things that he's, you know, to the best of my ability to assess, he's capable of doing. And so the DSM, I think, can be very helpful in that way in terms of giving us succinct descriptions of people's, of a problem or that a person might struggle with. That helps me to ask good questions. It helps me to walk alongside that person. Yeah.
That's incredibly insightful. We think about in that regard. I don't want to be crass, but it can provide some shortcuts and insights that might be helpful to the counselor, because people share and have a likeness to other types of people. So in this regard, it might tell you some particular struggles that this person may have and you can ask them about, whereas it might have taken you 4, 5, 6 sessions with a person to uncover those things.
Right. And in fact, I mean, that happens biblically as well. Like, yeah. if we say someone is struggling with fear of man, we have an idea in our mind of what that constitutes. Okay. It might constitute, shading the truth in order to please this person. It might be, you might overwork because you're wanting to please this person. You might be uncomfortable in certain social situations. So you might have a general idea of, oh, here's what it looks like, but you don't know that person until you sit down and you start asking them questions about, well, what does this really look like in your life? Where does people please it? Where does fear of man tend to present itself? And then that gives you some tracks to run on in terms of working with that person. So in the same way, if someone comes in with post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis. Well, it's helpful for me to know what the criteria are so that I can say, okay, this is what the struggle may look like. Now, how can I ask good questions? How can I walk alongside with this person in order to bring the riches of the gospel to bear on their lives?
Mm-hmm. Mike, I'm thinking of studies that I've heard and some listeners may have heard where for example, someone is having brain surgery and the brain surgeon can go in and kind of, you know, touch something and the arm raises or they smell something or and it seems to or at least some people seem to take that and then extend it to just a broader anthropology where we're just mechanistic beings that are, you know, programmed with our brain. And if you can just find the place in the brain to touch or whatever, then you'll cause whatever desired outcome you want. So that's number one. That seems to be at least a paradigm out there for some people. And then I guess my question would be, how much are you dealing with almost pre-programmed paradigms in the people that you counsel so that they have their own self-diagnoses coming into the counseling room that are either related to that or maybe something different?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, let's see. With the former part one of your question, I think yes, it's certainly true that there are ways in which you can localize or even create, you know, certain or evoke certain responses in someone. And some of these experiments were done years ago by a neurosurgeon named Penfield up in Canada in 30s, 40s, 50s, where yes, he could stimulate a certain part of the brain and the person would raise their arm almost involuntarily. And yet if he told them, hey, I'm going to do this, they could actually resist it, knowing that it was coming. So there were other, it's a lot more complex than that. And so, mm-hmm. And that's even true in the modern era as well, that we simply can't go in and manipulate the brain as simply as that. So it is a lot more complex. I think, and remind me again, the second part, Jared, of your
self-diagnosis, question. Wasn't
self-diagnosis,
it?
Yeah. I mean, I find in counseling at CCF, a lot of times people have already seen their primary physician, maybe they've seen a psychiatrist, and they already do come in with a diagnosis, as opposed to here, diagnose me or what do I have? And so my initial steps are generally, again, getting to know that person and the contours of their struggle. And as I get to know them, be able to tease out, you know, ways in which their heart is active in the midst of this struggle, and oftentimes it's, you know, they'll be the one to say, well, what do you think about, you know, the, you know, being on this medication, if they were on medication. And I mean, despite my medical background, my role is as a biblical counselor, so I'm going to direct them to go back to their physician, but say, hey, I'd be glad to talk to your physician in terms of what we've been doing in counseling to see if that impacts the kinds of ultimate decisions that are made that you all make regarding your medication.
Wow. One interesting point or subject that comes up when we talk about the DSM, its relationship to culture, and this idea of normality, and especially as the DSM has developed, is the issue of homosexuality. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that homosexuality in early versions was considered somewhat of a disorder. Is that correct?
It was, yes. And I can't remember. I know it was in DSM-1, and I can't remember if it was stricken in DSM-2 or DSM-3. I think it might have been DSM-3. Mm-hmm. But it is an example of how culture shapes psychiatric diagnosis. What was considered abnormal, deviant, mental illness in one era is not in a different era. So there are ways in which culture plays a role. So for example, here would be another one: premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD. Is now in the DSM-5 listed as an official diagnosis. And interestingly, it was proposed in earlier editions, but there's a way in which culture may be shaping that to come to the forefront in terms of a particular diagnosis. Not in any way to take away the fact that women, certain women, will struggle in particular ways, but I think could that have become a diagnosis in another cultural context? It's not a diagnosis in some other cultural context. So clearly, society is playing some role. Not to mention the fact that there's a medication that can be used, or that was marketed to be used in PMDD.
Wow. Yeah, I think that really points out the nature of the DSM, and some of those examples just illustrate its dependence upon whatever cultural ethos is out there. And that I think points out to, your article speaking about what is normal. But also I think Tim Lane had an article in the JBC, either that or at the 2011 National Conference on Disorders, speaking about normality. Mm-hmm. And your blog post, we'll have a link to it in our episode description, but it starts off with this almost dystopian future where we look, maybe 80 years down the road, and the last person to not have a disorder has now been diagnosed with something. Is that where you think this is headed?
Well, I think I actually don't think. I mean, that's definitely tongue in cheek.
I think.
But I think that I do think that there have been alarm bells ringing within the psychiatric community as well, in terms of saying we need to do a better job in terms of how we classify mental illness. And so I think, say, Alan Francis would be, a voice. Another, Paul McHugh, who was the former chairman of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, has also over the years raised concerns about the fact that this detailed, descriptive approach that doesn't really tell us or help us understand underlying issues that contribute to the causation of these problems. There have been these voices. I anticipate those voices will continue. In some ways, the fact that the DSM-5 didn't come out with 100 new diagnoses is actually encouraging to me. So I don't know that trend is going to continue per se. However, what hasn't fundamentally changed is the way the psychiatric community classifies mental disorders, and I think that's going to be an ongoing debate. I do anticipate that if the Lord tarries, there may well be further ability to pinpoint things, if you will, or to say that this is this particular gene or this particular part of the brain is at least correlated with these particular struggles. I think that kind of discovery will likely happen more over time. But in some ways, where we are with psychiatry is like general medicine was, 50, 100 years ago. It's a kind of a new frontier, and we shouldn't be surprised that the brain kind of defies that kind of deep exploration. That's part of being fearfully and wonderfully made. And whether or not we're ever going to be able to do that, I doubt. But there will be progress made in terms of localizing certain things or associating certain presentations of mental distress with what's going on in the brain.
Wow. Yeah, that's fascinating. And those are the mysterious questions of anthropology and the questions that we have guidelines for answering in Scripture, but yet ultimately are mysteries how our body and soul relate. But yet we're not left to wild speculation, but given God's revelation for thinking about, for exploring, and for asking these questions. If you're interested in this type of thing, I do want to point people to ccef.org. Just a wealth of resources there. Of course, I highly recommend the 2011 National Conference on Psychiatric Disorders. Those sessions are available on the website, as well as several JBC, Journal of Biblical Counseling, articles. Mike has one on understanding labels and diagnoses, but also David Powlison and Tim Lane have some other helpful ones. They've spoken about the DSM in the past. And also, I would encourage people to look at the work of Ed Welch, especially his book, Blame It on the Brain, can be very helpful for navigating some of these issues and the relationship between your physical brain and your spirit, your soul. So, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciate the opportunity to bring this information to our listeners, and we thank you so much for your time, all your studies, and also your willingness to share it with our listeners today.
It's been my pleasure, Camden. Thank you, and it's good to talk with you, Nick, and Jared as well.
Yeah,
Mike. Thanks, Mike.
It's been fantastic. Very encouraging as well. We do also want people to visit us online at reformedforum.org. There you'll find information about all of our programs as well as other episodes that we've had on counseling and other similar subjects. If you'd like to get a hold of us, just email us at mail@reformedforum.org, or you can tweet us at Reformed Forum. We want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.